This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. While the investigation is continuing into yesterday's bomb explosion in New York City, a pro-Islamic state group sought to tie the incident to last week's announcement that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That announcement from President Trump was countered in subsequent days by a European Union statement that the EU would not follow suit.
Contributor Art Sear regularly joins us to discuss global politics in a series of conversations called The Art of Foreign Policy, and he's here with me now. Art, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me back, Mitch. It's always a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to see you on a cold winter's day.
But it's always warm at WUWM.
Exactly. Well, and let's start with another place where it is typically warmer, although they do get snow in Israel, I guess. Starting with the Middle East, it's been pointed out that other U.S. presidents have pledged to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in the past. And I gather it has always been kind of a symbolic thing as much as anything. But what does this administration see as the imperative for actually following through on this?
It was a campaign pledge that President Trump made during his successful presidential campaign, and he's living up to the pledge. I'm not a world-class champion dealmaker. I hope something has been traded for this. It's a major move by the U.S. government, very welcome in Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu, who from my point of view, rarely has nice things to say about most people, has been quite rightly munificent in his praise. So I do hope the administration gets something.
Right. I mean, there's the question is what does the U.S. get out of doing this aside from, you know, potentially making Israel very happy and some American Jewish voters happy?
Yeah, it tends to isolate us, especially in Europe, which if it's worthwhile, it's certainly defensible. I have no inside information. It may be that there was no deal. I think one of the saving characteristics of President Trump, from my biased point of view, is that he doesn't actually do much. In this case, he's actually doing something. But if you actually pay attention, he communicates constantly, and not just by Twitter. But he hasn't, fortunately, I believe, done actually that much. And in this case, he's doing something. There are things we can get after the fact as well. It is a major move by the U.S. It's a big chip, as we might say, if we were in one of the president's casinos. and I do hope we press to get something significant.
Well, and I was trying to figure this out. I mean, obviously, as you say, this is not a popular decision in Europe. In fact, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was just in Brussels in the last couple of days to meet with the EU leaders, and the EU announced it will not follow the American lead, even though, you know, there are obviously nuances in how the various European leaders see Israel. None of them were willing to go out and say that they're going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital. A couple of questions here. Are there any other countries out there that for whom this is a popular decision?
Let me think about that.
I was trying to figure out if other countries there are any other countries out there that recognize
Jerusalem. No, not that I'm aware of. Israel is pretty isolated. We don't have to be shocked by the fact that Netanyahu did not get a warm welcome or get a lot of concessions from the Europeans.
Well,
except in the Casablanca sense, we can be shocked. But I think he went there. My reading of his temperament is to rub it in, basically.
Well, and so what is the EU's incentive to continue seeing Tel Aviv as the capital?
Well, that's what the international community has agreed upon. I would recommend that the U.S. government be slow in making the move. Israel's overseas international commercial involvements are considerable, and the government does face a number of barriers. We have a lot of commercial dimensions to any embassy, especially the U.S. embassy. We might leave commercial sections in Tel Aviv as a way of developing some chips of our own with the European Union as well as Israel. We might take our time in building the embassy.
Right. Again, this is not just a logistical thing. This isn't just a question of picking up and you know, loading the moving vans. And
right. No, it's going to take time. And I'm sure State Department diplomats will be anxious to take their time, and it might be one way for Secretary Tillerson, who's, as you implied, become rather alienated from the traditional professional diplomats, to build a coalition of his own within the State Department. I don't know, but there are lots of opportunities because Israel is such an important ally of the U.S. and should be. It's vital for us and we for them. and because there are so many dimensions to this.
We should talk briefly about Secretary of State Tillerson. You just mentioned he's somewhat isolated from the diplomatic community, and from what I gather, the State Department still has a hiring freeze in place. It was not so long ago, really just a week or two ago, that there were fairly well-sourced reports that Rex Tillerson was on his way out as
right.
Secretary of State. It's not the first time those reports have been there. Let me get your sense for whether he is likely to stay in this job much longer, and also, you know, what's the upshot to diplomacy for a department where many senior diplomats, Rex Tillerson aside, have either been pushed out or have retired and not been replaced?
Well, Washington is a nonstop rumor mill, and that's been true since it became the nation's capital. I can say that with great confidence. One past Secretary of State, like Tillerson, regarded as an honest and decent man with a very different background, was Dean Rusk. Now, through the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, but especially during the Kennedy years, there were nonstop rumors in Washington that he was about to be replaced. And Arthur Schlesinger Jr., a professor from Harvard, a great gadfly, constantly in the media as long as and constantly publishing and not at all influential, particularly with President Kennedy. He resigned after the assassination, was constantly reporting to us that Rusk, off the record, was about to go. The president's brother, Robert Kennedy, for whatever reason, took a dislike to him. Dean Rusk served for 8 years, the longest-serving Secretary of State, except, I think, in modern times, Cordell Hull, FDR's much beleaguered Secretary of State. I did not know him. I did know him very slightly back then, and very much a fine traditional Southern gentleman and a guy who stayed out of the news. And that's important to keep in mind during the current imbroglio.
It's interesting.
The latest among nonstop imbroglios in Washington.
We have not heard much from Rex Tillerson throughout this whole—
Exactly. That's one reason I brought up Mr. Rusk.
One person we have heard from, Vice President Pence, is
yes.
going to the Middle East in the coming days.
Exactly.
Palestinian Authority leaders say they will not meet with him. There have been reports that some in the Palestinian community have now, at this point, especially given the announcement about Jerusalem, written off the idea of a two-state solution and would rather just pursue an effort for equal rights. How do you see the current circumstances changing the dynamic about the Palestinian determination, if you will?
They won't change much, I don't think. I was discussing gambling it away. I think the vice president may turn out to be the shrewdest player at the poker table, ultimately, politically, because he and President Trump apparently are not close by more reliable reports, and that's fine. He has his own influence base. It may be to his advantage, but there's a good chance that he'll succeed.
Succeed in?
Becoming president. It'll be a test for his diplomatic skill. Again, referring to history, Richard Nixon established the vice presidency as a very powerful job because he was able to, among many other things, assert diplomatic influence without in any way— and he was very careful contravening or appearing to overstep or overshadow President Eisenhower. And since Richard Nixon, and we can thank him, especially on public media, I like to do, we have a much more institutionally stronger vice presidency today. I think that presidential leadership is crucial, and progress in the Middle East over the long history, whether it's Eisenhower and then Nixon and Kissinger, reducing and mitigating intense brutal war and conflict, or Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush and James Baker really carrying the peace process dramatically further. There's an established tradition, and a strong president is still in a position to make progress in the Mideast.
Significant, though, that Mike Pence is going to the Middle East as opposed to Rex Tillerson?
Not necessarily, no. No, I would not read a lot in that. It actually lends more prestige to the visit if it's the number two leader in the U.S. government. But that's a very good point. I always come away from discussions with you with something to think about and something to learn about.
As do I with
right.
you.
Well, it's not just your charm, Mitch. It's other things as well.
Let's pivot to North Korea for a moment here, and the stakes seem to continue to get larger in North Korea with every missile test and every threat and every kind of oblique response, and sometimes not so oblique response from the Trump administration, or really just President Trump himself. Speaking of isolation, is there anyone out there, any country, even China or Russia, who defends what North Korea is doing right now?
No. And you're quite right. Both can be a source of leverage on North Korea, which is totally dependent on China's economy, is a minor player compared to the South Korea-China economic relationship. North Korea, from the time it was established by the very powerful, very effective, very ruthless leader, Kim Il-sung. He was a Stalinist. He was a protege of Joseph Stalin. It was Stalin that encouraged and facilitated the attack on South Korea in 1950 that sparked the Korean War. Both of those powers have a capacity to influence North Korea. And in the past, during the, the Nixon administration, that president was able to orchestrate pressure on both the Soviet Union and China, which indirectly helped the U.S. Beleaguered war position in South Vietnam. And Nixon greatly mitigated the effects of our strategic defeat in Vietnam by opening the door to China. Really a tremendous example. My main point, without talking too long, is the South Koreans should really be encouraged to take the lead, and that's something that we are psychologically reluctant to do, clearly, at this point. But I think Obama was much more in line with that approach than Trump.
Well, and so what can South Korea's response, if we were to let South Korea lead in this case, how does South Korea approach North Korea in a time like this?
Well, that's up to them. It's their country. We have this terrible habit in this country, and I'm making no reference to you or any other individual, but collectively we tend to think everybody else wants to be an American. We're much less inclined to interfere in other people's business and their revolution since Vietnam. But it's really up to the South Koreans, and they have at the moment an extremely well-qualified, impressive president. In contrast to President Park, President Moon is really quite an extraordinary guy, and I would leave it up to them and provide support. They're our closest ally in the world outside of the British and the Australians and a couple of others.
Well, and the Japanese have to be very concerned at this point as well, right?
Of course. They're always concerned, and that's why North Korea is testing close to and over Japan. Absolutely. You're quite right to bring up the Japanese.
So, at this stage, how do our allies, say South Korea and Japan, notwithstanding, help dictate our approach to North Korean provocation?
Well, I think it's an opportunity for us to facilitate closer cooperation between South Korea and Japan, traditional enemies, but with a complicated love-hate relationship after the long Japanese occupation in the 20th century up until 1945, I think we should facilitate their collaboration between themselves. And I think that the more we can approach North Korea diplomatically with joint positions, the better. What Pyongyang wants is what we seem to be inclined to do currently. They want to deal directly with Washington and ignore Seoul and the South Koreans, and we should resist that forcefully.
Well, and it also raises a question. They want to deal directly with Washington, but what do they want to, you know, what are the terms they want to deal with? I mean, what is their end game here?
I'm not sure they have one beyond fear. They're terrified of us and have been since the Korean War for good reasons, very good reasons. And it's important for us to keep that in mind. I'm not excusing what they're doing or the insane regime, quite literally, in Pyongyang. But I think South Korea and Japan are in a good position to make reassuring steps without compromising security. But the North Koreans are terrified of us.
And so in a war of social media here, there's nothing that's been done to change that dynamic, has there?
Ignore social media. No, Trump actually feeds into their, I believe, without any disrespect to the office of the president, he feeds into Pyongyang propaganda, and he feeds into their images of us. Dwight Eisenhower achieved an armistice a few months after taking office as president in the summer of 53. We threatened to use the atomic bomb, quite rightly. We had a de facto monopoly, and that's public. Joseph Stalin conveniently died, which was helpful to getting the armistice. But we also started killing everyone in North Korea. And that's not in the public record. An awful lot of Eisenhower's most important moves, not just during World War II, were moves that he managed to keep out of the media. There were no military targets left in North Korea, and we started killing everyone. And I'm convinced that off the record, when the microphones and cameras were off at Panmunjom, U.S. officers said directly to their North Korean counterparts, "We're going to kill you all. And if somehow you live, you're going to thank God that you're not dead, and then you're going to wish you were dead. We've got enough B-29s to bomb you 24/7, as we're doing now. And there are no limits, and we proved that. We blasted dikes. Picture nothing but water, as far as the eye can see, with bodies of men, women, children, animals, a few trees sticking up, but we devastated everything. It's very hard to find any evidence of that in the public record. But the North Koreans are very much aware of that, and the armistice is held since 53. Let me reiterate, that armistice is held since 53. And that's the reason why.
It's a sober note to end on, but Artsir, I appreciate it.
Sober Thanks. But important. Well, thank you very much. I hope I've been clear in what I've said.
Foreign policy contributor Artsir is a professor of political economy and world business, and he's the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He regularly joins Lake Effect to talk about global politics in a series called The Art of Foreign Policy.